From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. Yes, the University of Oregon football coach and basketball coaches may get more notoriety, but perhaps no coach in town is more embedded with the ethos of Eugene than the head track and field coach at Oregon. After all, we are Tracktown USA. And it's the track and field program and its hallowed home turf, Hayward Field, that brings the world to town each year. Today on the show, you'll hear from Jerry Schumacher, the head coach of Oregon Track and Field, and hear how the team looks and what this spring and summer will bring to the aforementioned Hayward Field. And we'll finish the show with a U of O chemistry professor who, along with his team, may be on the cusp of a new process to make iron that could save tons of money and reduce tons of greenhouse gases. When you drive into Eugene, you're greeted with road signs that first mark our population, then mark our legacy. Tracktown USA. Today on the show, the man who leads the U of O track team joins us to talk about the season and all that track means to our community. Jerry Schumacher, the director and head coach for the University of Oregon track and field program and cross country, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Boy, obviously, you know, track and field is so huge in this community and certainly at the University of Oregon. You know, talk about some of the big meets you have coming up this year.
Yeah, this spring we actually have quite a few meets at Hayward Field, and obviously we love putting on meets there. It's it's a phenomenal environment for track and field, and our community has always supported it so well. So this spring we have our first team invitational coming up here on April 18th, and then following that up in May we have the Big Ten Championships. And that will be May 16th through the 18th.
Okay.
And then about a month after that, we have the NCAA National Championships, which will be June 11th through the 14th.
And kind of, you know, give us as best you can, kind of a preview, what you're looking forward to at these particular meets, or more importantly, what listeners should be clued into as what we're going to see in these marquee events coming up.
Right. So obviously, our men and women track and field athletes will be competing against other marquee teams in all of those competitions. In our team invitational coming up here in April, we have Texas A&M, Oklahoma State, Kansas State, Utah, Oregon State, Wichita State, Oregon, all coming in to obviously compete against the Ducks. And that's kind of a more of a regional, we have a lot of different regions represented that bring a lot of outside competition that we don't see typically in our conference meet. Mm-hmm. And so so they're coming in for a team competition. We will score the meet.
Okay.
It will be, again, every event will be contested and scored. And, it's for bragging rights, I think, more than anything else against some of these teams. But then we follow that up with the conference championships, which is always scored. It's always a huge meet for our track and field program. That is your backyard. You want to be good in your conference. This is the first year that we will be in the Big Ten, and that's super important to our program. We want to get out there and we want to compete well.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about that. With this sort of tectonic shift in college athletics, and you are this is the first year competing in the Big Ten. What's that been like for you, sort of getting ready for that? Obviously, you know, the Pac-12 is no slouch at all, of course, but you know, the Big Ten has perhaps even more of a national presence. What's it been like as a coach to get everybody sort of ready, plus the increased travel and all that comes with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a change, but we've enjoyed it. It's the competition is phenomenal. UCLA, USC, Washington, and Oregon all moved into the Big Ten, mm-hmm. which was already an existing phenomenal conference. And, those four schools added to it just powered it up even more. So it's been a transition because, now the conference is kind of more like, it's kind of got high level national feels to it. Not the same because it doesn't have everybody in the country, but
sure,
it's got a lot of great players. So it's definitely amped up the competition to the conference meet already. So we've enjoyed it. the travel is what it is. Mm-hmm. We make do with how we have to do it, and everyone's going to travel to some extent, and that's the way our sport is rolling, and that's the way the conferences are going now. So we're going to adapt and make sure that we're always ready to go.
Does that put more challenges on you to sort of get your athletes ready for that kind of travel? Does it interrupt with sort of the routine of training and whatnot, or how do you kind of manage around that? It's obviously going to a classic Big Ten school versus going to Oregon State or Washington or sure. something like that is a bit different.
Yeah, it doesn't change much for us. I feel like we were going to travel that weekend regardless.
Okay,
it might be a little bit longer trip, but other than that, it doesn't really travel as far as the time and energy we have to put into getting to our location. It doesn't change much. Obviously, this year we don't have to travel, so it's pretty nice for us. But I'm sure future years we'll be traveling, and that'll just be part of the game, like everybody else has to do as well.
Sure. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to the head coach and director of University of Oregon Track and Field, Jerry Schumacher. If you could, is there an area, is there part of the team that is particularly strong this year? Middle distance, the milers, is there a group that really is the superstars of the entire track and field team?
Well, obviously, we pride ourselves on having a complete program.
Okay.
We try to cover all event areas really well.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of had the sprints and hurdles and relays as an area. We have our throws area. We have our jumps and multis area. Then we have our middle distance and distance area. And all of those areas are very important to our track and field program.
Mm-hmm.
I think this year, although we've covered it really well indoors, I think we had all of our areas actually scored, especially on our women's team that actually won the NCAA title. So mm-hmm. it was pretty fun to kind of just see all those groups represented. So we really don't try to have one area that's better than the other.
Okay.
But we are strong in, I think, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even this year, I think you'll see even a little bit more, maybe a little bit more power out of the middle distance and distance area. Traditionally, Oregon's always been kind of known in that area, dating all the way back to the years of Bowerman.
Sure.
And that's carried through, I think, since that time. And we obviously, we're very proud of that as well, our tradition and history. And I guess if there was a backbone to the program, we would call that kind of the backbone, but we want to be good at everything.
So. Sure. I'm wondering too, all of us who go to track meets at Hayward Field, and we're spoiled. We're so used to that venue. I just wonder, when athletes come in, or coaches or the support personnel, when they come to Hayward Field, do they kind of come up to you and say, wow, this is amazing?
Absolutely. It's impossible not to. I mean, I'm 3 years in, and I'm there every single day, and every single day I say the same thing. I look at it, and I'm still amazed by it. We're so fortunate and so lucky to have a facility like that, to have the support of the community for track and field, and to have an administration that really gets behind our sport. It's not like that everywhere, so we know we're lucky and we're very fortunate, and I think that's what also is the big draw for other teams wanting to come to Hayward Field and compete. It's a great place to compete. I remember when I got to compete here when I was in college, and it was a great moment for me. I loved it. It was one of those things where you leave here and you say, wow, I can't wait to go back and compete there again.
Yeah. Of course, with the grand scale of Hayward Field, what we don't have is an indoor track facility as such, and I'm just wondering, what kind of benefit would that have for what you're doing in terms of maintaining and building a program to have a facility like an indoor track facility?
Sure. I think, I think on the traditionally and historically speaking, the West Coast never really had to do indoor track because the weather's never been, tough enough where people had to go indoors. Indoor track has just been growing rapidly. It's one of those, I think to me, it's a great bridge to the outdoor season. And a lot of teams, they really embrace the indoor track season. Do I think an indoor track facility would help us here? Sure. I mean, I think it would be great for our community. It's great for the fans. You walk in, you have your drinking popcorn, and you take your coat off and you sit in a cozy building. It's very intimate because mm-hmm. it's a 200 meter track versus a 400 meter track. You're right on top of the athletes. I think there's a lot of advantages that would really be fun for a community like this to have indoor track. Plus, we get to stay home a lot and compete more. I think that's a true advantage. It wasn't really a necessity in the past, but I think it's growing in that direction where indoor track is becoming something very important. And I think it's a great, for us, it would be a great bridge to kind of bring bring the outdoor track season and the fans and the excitement of outdoor track to bring a smaller scale indoors to that. Not that it changes our outdoor season at all, but I think it could be a nice little, it'd be a great resource for us.
Sure, sure. You know, a lot of college sports fans in the last couple of years, you know, so much has been talked about in terms of NIL and the transfer portal, and that certainly is huge in football and basketball. I'm wondering how it impacts track and field and how, as a coach, as a recruiter, as someone who's building a program, how does this sort of kind of a lot more mobility amongst athletes, how do you kind of prepare for that and make sure that you're able to put the best product you possibly can on the track?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I'm a big believer in. You have to adapt. Mm. You have to adapt, and you have to change with the times. And NIL is a real part of you know, college athletics today. There's constantly more changes coming, as we see. You know, every day there's new rules and new changes that are coming about for all sports. So what we're going to do is we're going to follow the rules. We're going to adapt to whatever the changes are and try to be the best possible program we can within those changes. We know other teams and other programs are doing the same thing. So we're not going to get stuck in the past and try to keep doing things the same way it's always been done. We're going to keep evolving.
And speaking of evolving, you know, you've been here for a few years. What are some of the, I don't know, what are some of the you know, changes, some of the kind of improvements, whether it's training or equipment or things that are kind of in your mind as an expert looking at track and field and going, wow, this is really propelling the sport forward?
Yeah, well we're seeing a lot of that just with, I think, shoe technology.
Sure.
So yeah. Shoe technology is really changing things quite a bit. So the times that maybe have been, you know, used in the past for performances might not be as relevant today as they were in the past. But as those changes and as we adapt to the shoe technology that's changing, you know, I think track technology is changing. There's something called, you know, wave lights now, pace lights. So they can actually set lights up around the track and they can set it at a certain pace. And you know, that's,
wow.
You know, you want to run world record pace, they can set a world record pace. I mean, you still have to do the running and do it, but
sure.
But the lights will move at that pace, so mm-hmm. It will let you know what's going on, which is kind of fun for the fan experience because they can look at the lights and they can see what different paces mean. And you know, so I think those changes are definitely, they're improving the sport, they're making it better, and it keeps things exciting.
You know, my last question for you, Jerry, is what I love about track and field, especially at such a high level here, is that, you know, it is the event, it is the sport that brings the world to Eugene. We obviously saw that with the World Championships, but I imagine as a track coach, I mean, there are so many international athletes that are competing in track, and obviously there are meets all over the world. What's that like, I guess, both in terms of a sport, but and also in terms of, you know, the idea of sort of building this global community through a sport like track and field?
Right, and that's the probably the best piece about Eugene, Oregon, is that not only do they get track and field, they're fans of track and field. They pack in the stadium, they fill the stadium. That's what we're hoping is going to happen, you know, for our upcoming meets here, that the fans turn out and really support the Ducks. And obviously, it continues on beyond the NCAA season. The Prefontaine Classic, which is a huge international, it's a Diamond League event, that will be held on July 4th here. Or is it July 5th? July 5th.
July 5th.
July 5th here. The USA Championships will be at the end of July, beginning of August. So we have the biggest and best meets beyond even the college landscape. So internationally speaking, this place is recognized as one of the gems, and they love to come here and compete. You know, collegiate-wise speaking, you know, all teams in the NCAA there's a lot of international level athletes, and we're no different. We have a lot of international attention. A lot of athletes from all over the world want to come here and be a part of our program, and that's great. It's fun to have. It's a great learning experience for the domestic athletes when they get to be paired up with international athletes and different cultures come together. So we've really had great experiences with all of our international athletes. We hope that continues, obviously, and just bringing in international competition from other teams or from across the globe for our bigger competitions is always welcome.
Jerry Schumacher, he's the head coach and director of Oregon Track and Field. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
Yeah, thank you again.
Iron development is vital to industry, but it pollutes a lot. Next on the show, you'll hear from a U of O professor who is experimenting with a new process that could be cheaper and greener. Assistant Professor of Chemistry at the University of Oregon, Paul Kempler, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Yes, it's my pleasure, Michael.
Yeah. So I saw this this study, this report about your team sort of advancing a way to produce sort of greener iron. Talk about it.
Yeah, you know, iron is a huge problem for people who are interested in greenhouse gas emissions, really just because we make so much of it, billions of tons per year. And we've been looking for ways here with my research group to make iron from minerals, but without using carbon as a reducing source, without a process that would lead to carbon dioxide emissions. And okay. So this is another step in that process for us, looking at how quickly we can make iron using electricity to drive the reaction instead of carbon.
So you take the inputs and you apply electricity to it. What sort of, tell us sort of the steps that it goes through.
Yeah, we start with a powder of iron oxide, mm-hmm. and put that into a solution. In a full process, we really think the only inputs we need are iron oxide, electricity, and salt water. But in the cell, it's a slurry. It looks like red paint, actually, and it's probably not too different chemically than red paint, except for the solvent that it's in. But it's a slurry of iron oxide particles that are recirculating, and they're sticking to the surface of one of our electrodes and reducing directly down to iron metal. We come out with a very high purity plate of iron when we're done with the reaction.
And for our audience, compare and contrast how you normally get iron compared to what you've been able to do in this process.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't be more different. Typical reactors that make iron and steel today are these large blast furnaces, which take in coke as a reducing agent made from coal. And they're pumping in hot gases and putting out a molten iron product, 1500 degrees Celsius, much, much hotter than temperatures that you and I are familiar to running into in our day-to-day lives.
Sure.
And they're doing that, though, at a much larger scale than what we've been able to do yet in our lab. But we're working on that process, trying to scale up from kind of the gram scale to the kilogram scale to hopefully, you know, in not too distant future, the tonnage scale. And the main difference in how we do it is that we can do this all at a temperature less than, you know, a cup of hot coffee. That we have a warm bath and we're putting electricity through, but there's no more CO2 emissions directly while we're making the iron. And then we also don't have to go to those really extreme temperatures required to melt iron metal.
And a lot of the polluting aspects of iron sort of come from those high temperatures. Is that what I'm hearing?
They come from the high temperatures and also the fact that we're using, in general, either coal or natural gas to reduce iron oxide to iron metal. And so it's the step of removing oxygen, actually, from the minerals that is the difficult step to do. And if you use coal or natural gas, those things also tend to have some other impurities in them that when you burn them, just like the issues associated with burning fuels to drive a car around or burning fuels in the home, all of these little trace particulate emissions that come from those processes, when you add them all up to the billion tons per year scale, it actually can have a big impact on human health. So. Yeah. We hope that by eliminating the CO2 emissions and eliminating all the other emissions that come with it, that it could be a much cleaner way of making iron metal.
Okay. You talked about scaling this up. You know, kind of what are the hurdles in your way to get to that scale? Is it a question of, is there science involved in terms of those hurdles, or is it money and resources?
All of the above, Michael.
Okay.
but we're working on the science right now. That's what we do. Here at the university, we have some industry partners that we're starting to work with to try to figure out if this makes sense on the scale that they're able to operate on. In our lab, we're really asking the questions of what are the scientific hurdles that would prevent you from scaling up a process like this. And okay. So we're building larger and larger reactors. And one of the graduate students who's on this paper is one of the co-first authors. He's Andrew Goldman is really working to understand what are the scientific challenges that prevent you from doing this at a scale that would be meaningful.
Okay. I mean, best case scenario, you know, if you can crack through the science and stuff, what might iron production look like, you know, in the future with what you're doing compared to what we sort of have to endure now?
Yeah, so today there's actually a number of metals that we produce at low temperatures using electricity. Copper and zinc are the first two that come to mind in terms of scale. And those are made in very large warehouses with arrays of these large plates that are growing a metal film using electricity. And there's their own challenges with scaling that up and making it work. But what they don't have to do is directly consume any fossil fuels to make those metals. And then there's also no CO2 emissions coming directly from those sources. And so we don't know exactly what this will look like yet in terms of all the steps needed to go from a rock to a piece of iron at low mm-hmm. temperature. But we think that they could look quite similar to some other existing electrochemical processes is the word that we use for this type of step.
Okay. Well, it'll be fascinating to watch. University of Oregon Assistant Professor in Chemistry, Paul Kempler, talking about this new production possibility for iron. Thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
My pleasure, Michael. Thanks for reaching out.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, you'll hear about the growing problem of human trafficking in Lane County and what the DA's office, the FBI, and an area nonprofit are doing about it. I'm Michael Dunn, and this has been Oregon on the Record from KLCC. Thanks for listening.